the medical issues of AIDS. We'll hear from someone who has AIDS. We'll hear from a buddy who works with people who have AIDS. Then we'll hear from a panel of doctors, social workers, and epidemiologists who are going to discuss the spread of AIDS, how contagious it is. We're going to talk about safe sex. And then Friday, the programs will be devoted to the social, political, and ethical implications of this new epidemic. So that's Thursday and Friday, two programs about AIDS on Fresh Air. The time now is 2 minutes after 4 o'clock. This evening at 5 on All Things Considered, we'll hear about the latest developments on those devastating storms in the West. Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes, and mudslides are blocking highways and railroads. Also today, a conversation with chamber orchestra conductor Alexander Schneider about his relationship with Pablo Casals. That's beginning at 5 tonight on All Things Considered, and that will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Let me remind you also that the first Saturday in March, March 1st, we begin a new program, Weekend Edition, which is kind of like the Saturday edition of Morning Edition. It's a review of the week's issues, reviews of movies and TV shows and so on. So that's Saturdays 8 to 10 in the morning, beginning in March. Well, with me now for a return visit to Fresh Air is exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus. On his last visit, we talked about his anti-apartheid activism in South Africa and his imprisonment there. Today he's going to give a reading for us, and we'll discuss his impressions of the South African government's proposed reforms and the current violent protests against the apartheid system. Dennis Brutus grew up in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. He helped lead the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. The government retaliated against his efforts to integrate sports by firing him from his job teaching high school English and banning him from participating in political and social activities. In 1963, he was arrested for breaking the ban. He was shot and nearly killed when he tried to escape. He was given 18 months of hard labor at South Africa's most brutal prison, Robben Island. That was followed by a sentence of 5 years under house arrest. The order also prohibited him from writing anything that could be published. After 1 year under house arrest, Brutus signed an exit permit which allowed him to leave the country but guaranteed his immediate imprisonment if he returned. After living in exile in England for 5 years, he moved to the United States in 1970. He was given permanent resident alien status in 1983 after a long battle with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which tried to deport him. Brutus has served on the faculties of several American universities. This semester, he's a visiting professor of English at Swarthmore College. He also currently chairs Africa Network, which distributes information on South Africa. A few months ago, we recorded a biographical interview about his life in South Africa, and that will be featured on the Best of Fresh Air this Sunday at 6 o'clock. By the way, Dennis Brutus is going to give an open-to-the-public reading that I want to tell you about, and that's at Swarthmore College, March 19th, at Kirby Hall at 7:30 in the evening. Dennis Brutus, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Before I ask you to read some poems, I'm interested in finding out why you have permanent resident alien status in America as opposed to opting for citizenship?
Yes, I've given it a lot of thought, and one reason why I decided not to apply to become an American citizen was that by implication I would be saying I have no South African citizenship. I would be, in a sense, accepting the right of the minority government to deprive me of my South African citizenship. Since I hope to return to a free South Africa in due course and take up my rightful citizenship there, I prefer simply to be a resident alien here in the United States.
Are there already plans underway or discussion among exiles like yourself about what kind of system might be put into place if and when the apartheid system falls?
Yes, there's a good deal, and particularly in recent months. But I should say it goes all the way back to 1955, when in South Africa people drafted a document for what they saw as the new South Africa and a new constitution. It's called the Freedom Charter, and it is in fact the basis of most of our planning and discussion now. I should say that Pittsburgh University, for one, is planning a series of symposia on post-apartheid South Africa, political and economic and educational structures in the new society. Also, the Yale International Review, or one of the Yale journals, is preparing a special issue which will look at post-apartheid South Africa. So obviously there's a good deal of discussion going on outside. There's also some going on inside. And of course we've had white businessmen, white politicians, white students meeting with representatives of the African National Congress, the major resistance movement. And clearly they too are thinking about the kinds of alternative structures we will have to have.
What are some of the alternative structures that you favor?
Well, certain obvious ones, of course. We start with a dismantling of the apartheid system. The very first thing we'll have to do is to demolish and expunge from the statute books all the racist laws. And we look for a redistribution of the land, a redistribution of the wealth, a free access to university education by everybody, the removal of discrimination, not just on the grounds of race, but also gender, because you do have laws which discriminate against women specifically. So obviously one of the first things to do is to build a new legal structure. But then you also have to design a new electoral process. How are people going to be represented in the new parliament? What will be the lawmaking process? And then one gets into the more complex areas of the economy. The position as of now, as stated by Oliver Tambo, as the president of the African National Congress, is that South Africa, free South Africa, would welcome foreign investment, would welcome foreign corporations, although this is sometimes held up as one of the kinds of scarecrows to tell people that they ought not to support the resistance because they would exclude foreign investment. On the other hand, he did add that an independent South Africa would recognize very clearly who were its friends and who were its enemies, who had supported the oppressed and who had supported the oppressor, so that it is important for corporations to decide whose side they are on, because that will determine how welcome or unwelcome they will be in a free South Africa. Of course, the resources will remain. We still have the largest diamond mines in the world, the largest gold-producing country in the world, very high up in the world in the production of things like platinum, other minerals. And what we will have to do, of course, is to devise more efficient and more just ways of using labor. But with a population of 26 million, and much of it people who are highly skilled and working already in the 300 American corporations and the other industries, clearly we have a huge industrial labor force, which means there's just tremendous potential for expansion. It will be a very prosperous economy, one that can help other parts of Africa. But all that, I think, depends on it first being a just society.
You've obviously been planning for this for a long time. Realistically, when do you think that the apartheid system would actually end and white rule would end?
Well, I'd like to quote Bishop Tutu speaking right here in Philadelphia. He said that it would take less than a year for the apartheid system to collapse if the United States stopped supporting it. And so, in a sense, all our timetables are contingent on this particular imponderable. We don't know at what point the United States will do what it did to Duvalier in Haiti. The moment they cut off aid, that was it. They could tell him, now take your walking ticket and go. We'll even arrange a plane for you to get out. I think it's happening in the Philippines now. The signal to Marcos, from Congress at least, is that he can no longer rely on roughly $200 million a year coming into his country unless there is a change. There's $14.6 billion of American money in South Africa. The apartheid government tomorrow is supposed to face a deadline for the repayment of short-term loans in the sum of $24 billion. If the American banks simply say we are not going to allow a further rollover, we're not going to allow this debt to be rescheduled, and instead say it's come due and we demand payment, that would be enough. So you would not even need to cut off support. All you would have to say is, come on, you signed to repay and we want you to repay now that it's come due. What I fear is going to happen is that the banks are going to say, okay, we rolled it over for 6 months, we'll roll it over for another 6 months. And all that is buying time for the system, is enabling apartheid to survive. So the key is right here, what the United States does to indicate that it will no longer subsidize the system is the crucial issue.
I want to talk to you more about other governments' assistance in keeping up the apartheid system, and also about the current protests in South Africa. But I'd really like for you to do a reading for us. So why don't I ask you to read some poems, and then we'll continue our discussion. And let me reintroduce you. My guest is exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus, who this semester is a visiting professor at Swarthmore College.
Okay, Terry, I'd like to start, and this might surprise you, with a non-political poem. It's really a poem about how I see poetry working, or if you like, my strategy in poetry, what I seek to do. And I would like to think the poem speaks for itself, so I won't have to say any more. But it will lead, of course, into political discussion. But by itself, it's a totally non-political poem. Sometimes a mesh of ideas webs the entranced mind, the assenting, delighted mental eye. And sometimes the thrust and clash of forged and metalled words makes musical clangor in the brain. And sometimes a nude and simple word, standing unlit or unadorned, may plead mutely in silence or dark for an answering warmth and enlightening sympathy. State the bare fact and let it sing. And I guess what I'm arguing is that sometimes one does not need to persuade people what they ought to think or what they ought to feel, that on occasion, and this doesn't work all the time, but there are occasions where the barest statement will evoke a resonance in the mind or the heart of the person who hears it. And so the fact does the work for you. You don't need to adorn it or dress it up, the fact itself. And in a sense, of course, what I was also doing was stating my own poetic, if you like, my own basis for judging poetry. So right after that, I wrote a very simple one, which in a sense tries to follow that prescription. It was a response, in fact, as far as I remember, to someone who said, well, actually, this man says he's an exile, but he isn't really an exile because he hasn't really left his country, which amused me because it's partly true in the sense that there's a part of my mind that simply continues to inhabit South Africa. But in another sense, I knew it was not true, and so this is my response. I am the exile, am the wanderer, the troubadour, whatever they may say. Gentle I am, and calm, and with abstracted pace, absorbed in planning, and courteous to civility. But wailings fill the chambers of my heart, and in my head, behind my quiet eyes, I hear the cries and sirens. I should say that the sirens there are not your metaphorical sirens of mythology, but the sirens of the police cars coming into the ghetto at night, mainly for people to be arrested, of course, and the pass laws, the whole system of control by the police and the army, which is now supposedly being revised, and we should talk about that, I think. But let me go on reading one or two more bits of poetry. I think this one was written in Denver in the time of snow. In Colorado can be pretty snowy. But occasionally one would come across a bit of lawn where the grass survived and even peeked out through the snow and the ice. And I would feel a kind of compassion for this struggling growth in the dead of winter. And so the poem takes off from that point. Ought we to walk on the bruised grass, patient, most patient, in the searing cold? Grimly, sear yellow, burnt dun, enduring the winter's weight, its uniform load. Ought we to add our personal inflictions? While men lie on concrete or fumble stones with torn hands or sigh their cold breath in the cold, unlighted night. The images I'm connecting are, of course, the grass and one inflicting hardship on it. But then I'm also thinking of the people in prison in South Africa, and particularly on Robben Island, where I spend time. And I worked with them, of course. We fumbled stones. We were given stones each day and hammers, and we broke stones. And at night we lay on the concrete floor and with a little rubber mat and a single blanket. And in winter, this is pretty grim. And in a sense, the most terrifying thing, of course, about lying there at night for most of the prisoners, Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, and the others, is the knowledge that they're going to be there until they die. Because a life sentence in South Africa in prison means until you're dead. And I suppose I'm thinking of those outside who could either ease the burden or, in fact, increase the burden by either supporting the system so that they continue in prison or ending their support for the system. So I guess, unlike the earlier non-political one, this has a clear political undertone. One other written from about the same period, which again leads to some of the contemporary issues, because what we see at present in South Africa is people dying for two reasons, among others. I'm just focusing on two. There are those who die because they oppose the system, and there are those who die because they support the system, and who are then seen by the people living with them in the same ghetto, but they are seen by their neighbors as enemies, since they function as informers who lead the police in to do the killings. And so one has this kind of double tension, and the poem picks up on that. And some men died in agony and dishonor before they could see this time. And others are blinded by rheum, sink dissolutely in their own vomit. And ambition scales the eyes of those who wallow in success. and some now living will not live to see a new sunlight with other shadows, and the scab shanties bleached to remembered scars. Okay, I don't know if we should take one more before we go into the discussion, if you wish. I'll have to find one. This is back on Robben Island again. I wrote poems there, of course, which were part of a series called Letters to Martha, which I sent to Martha, who was my brother's wife, my sister-in-law, because he went to Robben Island after I came out. And so I tried to share the experience with her. This one is part of a sequence about being on Robben Island. When the rain came, it came in a quick moving squall, moving across the island, murmuring from afar, then drumming on the roof, then marching, fading away. And sometimes one mistook the weary tramp of feet as the men came shuffling from the quarry, white dust filmed and shambling for the rain that came and drummed and marched away. What I'm trying to do is build a kind of counterpoint between the men who are on the island and who remain on the island and the rain which moves across the island going to the mainland. And there's a similarity between the swish of their feet in the sand and the swish of the rain on the roof. But there's this essential difference that whereas the rain moves away, they remain there.
Thank you for reading those poems for us. And if you would, I'd like you to read some more before we end the show today. My guest is poet Dennis Brutus, who is living in exile from South Africa. He's currently a visiting professor at Swarthmore College. I think it would probably be hard at this point in South Africa to get a Botha or any of the people in government to actually come out and say, yes, we live in the apartheid system and we defend it and we want it to continue, because the kinds of things that the people in government are saying now and the ambassador to America, who I interviewed a couple of months ago, is that they've outgrown the outdated concept of apartheid and that they're currently trying to make appropriate reforms to change the system. So they are not overtly speaking in support of apartheid. What does that say to you?
Well, several things. One, of course, is that they are responding to pressure, both internally and externally. We have the bankers screaming at them. We've even had President Reagan speak unfavorably of them. And, of course, you have the student protest and divestment and Congress trying to get sanctions, plus the internal pressure. So, obviously, they're responding to that. But I think the other and perhaps more important thing is to insist that the changes they're talking about are cosmetic, that the reality hasn't changed. On the contrary, the reality is worse than it was before. And of course, one has to support a statement like that. So let me just look at what I think is two of the central elements of the apartheid system and find out whether, in fact, they're being abandoned or not. One, which I think everybody knows about, is known as the Pass Law, which controls the movement of blacks into the cities and out of the cities, keeps them out until they're needed as labor, and if they come in, forces them out by what is called relocation, forced removals, using a set of laws called Influx Control and the Pass Laws and the Group Areas Act. These are pieces of legislation. Now, Botha is saying he's considering abandoning this whole portion of the legislation. Of course, we've heard it before many times. all the way back to Jan Smuts in 1946 at the time of the Second World War. He said that segregation has fallen on evil days. You know, that's 40 years ago. They talked of changing the system. Now in 86, we hear Botha say the same thing, but he couples it instantly with saying they are going to devise a new system called orderly urbanization. And orderly urbanization is the past laws under a new name. It is the same control of movement of blacks into and out of the cities. It is liability to arrest, to be displaced, to lose your home, to be forcibly removed. So until they scrap the system, it doesn't matter what they call it. But apartheid remains. Let me just pick up on the other central issue. The whole basis of apartheid, and the word, of course, means apartness, is to keep black and white apart. And in keeping black and white apart, they not only designated 87% of the land for whites and 13% for blacks, but they then took the 13% for the blacks and carved it up into 10 segments that they call Bantustans. And so you have your black population divided, and over each section you have a man appointed by the Pretoria government, and they set up the apparatus of a satellite state or a client state, which is pretty much controlled from Pretoria. Good, that was how it was. The question now is that being abandoned? And the answer is no. In the same speech in which he said apartheid is an outdated concept which we have outgrown, he went on to say that we are going to devise a new political structure in which the blacks will have some advisory role, not a legislative role. They're still going to be excluded from the right to make the laws. The laws will be made about them. But the most that they will get is participation through advisory structures, which will be based on the Bantustans. So you're still deriving your apartheid structures, whatever the name might be. And unless those are abandoned, I think there is no real change.
Do you think that black South Africans who oppose apartheid would just as soon not participate in that advisory position and reject it totally?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know of any society where you can't find a few Uncle Toms if you go out and look for them. We've seen a classic instance in the case of the coloureds, who now are part of the parliamentary structure but are not allowed to eat in the same restaurant with the white members of parliament, and who are now screaming blue murder because they thought that if they agreed to go along with the system, they'd get all the perks out of the system and the stigma of racial inferiority would be removed. But it hasn't happened. So you will always find a few, for good or bad reasons, who will go along. But, as you may know, when the coloureds were invited to vote, 84% boycotted the election, and the Asians, 86%. So while you may have the few who collaborate, you have the overwhelming majority who reject the system and decline to participate.
So you have really nothing good to say about any of the proposed reforms?
None at all, because if anything, on the one hand, it's the mixture as before, and on the other hand, what it represents, and I don't think people in America understand this, is that the apartheid system is becoming more brutal, more repressive than it has been before. This past week, the police admit they killed about 14. The minister in charge of law and order says it was over 18 over one weekend. And the clergy, who were in touch with the victims and their families, say, in one township. This is Alexandra. 80 people at least died, and over 200 were wounded. So while there is this impression that things are getting better, the truth is that in terms of the ruthlessness of the army and the police, it has in fact become worse.
Well, before we talk about what's happening in Alexandra, one effect that I could see of the proposed reforms is that people in other countries would pick up the newspapers and say, well, they're taking care of that. That's one less issue for me to worry about. Are you concerned that the proposed reforms might diffuse international outrage about apartheid?
Yes, but of course we've seen this in other parts of the world. A Duarte in El Salvador holds elections, and then people say, ah, now we have a democratic society. One must have the gravest suspicions about Haiti under the junta. These are the people who shared power with Duvalier, who are now in power. They've already started tear gassing protesters and demonstrators. One must even question whether a change of government in the Philippines, which is allegedly designed to come in and preserve a new, more democratic system, but which says, well, we're interested in keeping the bases, Air Force and Navy, and we're interested in wiping out the communists, you know, when I think they are people with legitimate grievances who are not communists. But in South Africa, I think we'll see a kind of a whitewash. And the outside world is anxious to believe that things are improving, and so they will say that things are improving. Fortunately, I don't think it will work for two reasons, the one in South Africa and the one in the United States, because I see the new pressures we are building up in terms of protests, divestment, even legislative action at the state level, the congressional level, and very particularly the actions we are planning for April, March of this year, which I'd like to talk about. I see them building such powerful pressures, both externally and internally, that we are going to see the U.S. government forced to change its posture, and we're going to see the Buerta government compelled to make some reforms which are genuine as opposed to cosmetic. So I'm really quite optimistic.
Before we talk about the actions that you mentioned, yesterday Bishop Desmond Tutu went to Alexandria, which was the site of the protests that you were talking about, where somewhere between 14 and over 80 people have killed, depending on whose reports you believe. The police said 14 and clergy are saying over 80. So he went there to basically tell people to be more calm and quiet themselves and cease the violent protests. And I wonder if you have any idea now how he'd be seen. Now, it seemed to be effective. Apparently, people listened and the demonstrations broke up. But how do you think he's seen by people who were really just on the edge now? Is he seen as someone who's trying to quiet them when what they need is more protests, or is he seen as being too conciliatory to the government in that respect?
Yes. I'm not sure that is the question that should concern us. I don't mind discussing it, but I think there is another one. At the point where the people begin to perceive him as functioning on behalf of the government, willy-nilly, whether he intends to or not, when his function is to contain their rage and their protest, I think he will be discredited at that point and will no longer be listened to. As I see it, what happened, say, in Alexandra, and incidentally the name is curious, it is Alexandra, not Alexandria, which people might think it would be. It's named after one of the members of the royal family in Britain, dating back to the old days when South Africa was part of the British Commonwealth and the Queen was the head of the country. one of the princesses was Princess Alexandra. And so this very curious ghetto, it's unlike Soweto, because whereas Soweto is outside Johannesburg, Alexandra is jammed between the center of the city and the expensive white suburbs on the edge of the city. And so it becomes an enormously dangerous place. What the government and the Johannesburg City Council did was to pursue a policy of benign neglect. There are very few lights. The roads are unpaved. There's barbed wire and it's surrounded and there are lights on the edge of the perimeter. But there are shanties, there are beer halls, there are illegal drinking places, a great deal of crime and vice. It's almost like something out of Orwell's 1984. You have the prolies and you keep them happy, the proletariat, with booze and drugs and sex and violence, the killings all the time. And it's run, many sections, by gangsters who run it by a kind of mob rule, a kind of mafia of their own. But here you have this area. Now, the curious thing is the government has always seen it as a kind of explosive place. And the latest moves, which they've just abandoned, over the past couple of years, they try to clean it up, to declare it a white spot, make it an all-white area, send in the bulldozers, flatten the homes, and force these people out. They haven't succeeded. Not only have they failed, but they now say they've abandoned the plan to make it a white spot, which is very interesting. But Alexandra is, in some ways, quite unlike the average South African ghetto, say, Dube and Mufulo and the places in Soweto. Soweto, of course, is a whole complex of about 1 million people in the southwest townships. That's how you get the word Soweto, from the S-O-W-E-T-O. But Alexandra is a much more rambunctious kind of uncontrollable shantytown. And so the government has a great deal of trouble with it. And Tutu going in there, certainly, he doesn't live in that area, but that he went in there clearly to diffuse the protest is important. And one must remember the context. People were burying those who had been killed by the police. And fresh killings took place while they were engaged in burying others who had been killed by the police. So there's profound rage and anger there. And the danger is if Tutu is seen as in fact coming in to pacify them because the government wants them pacified, then he will be completely discredited. And I think he is himself conscious of that possibility. Of course, one doesn't want to see people killed. But if Tutu wants to stop the killings, it's not the blacks he should be talking to. It is to Botha and to Botha's army and Botha's police that he should be talking to. The army has been sent into Alexandra. It is virtually in a state of siege. It is under conditions of an occupied territory, like Port Elizabeth, my hometown. And above all, this is what angers the people, that 24 hours a day they're under the guns of the army. And so they're calling primarily for the withdrawal of the army. That's their central call. And that is what Tutu must address. And if he succeeds in getting the army withdrawn, then of course it would give him a lot more credibility. But to go in and say to the people, go easy, when they see their children being killed around them, this is absurd. It won't work.
My understanding is that in many ways the children have become the activists behind the demonstrations and are the people leading the most violent parts of the demonstration. And let me quote something that Tutu said yesterday when he went to Alexandra. He said, "We are proud of the courage of our children. We are proud because they have told us that we have been cowards, but we don't want our children to be killed like flies." Do you think that there's any rapport now between the younger people of South Africa who are at the forefront of the more violent protests and Bishop Tutu?
I don't know. I think we see a tendency in South Africa, which we're seeing in other parts of the world as well, in El Salvador, certainly in Nicaragua, where you have very young people getting involved. Because, you see, a guerrilla army is not a formal army. I mean, you can't limit it to people by age or training. So there is this, I think, almost international manifestation of the young getting involved in being killed and killing much earlier. I think it's a very horrifying development. It's something that says something terrible about what we're allowing human nature to do to itself when the young must be involved both in being killed and in the killings. In South Africa, it has a very special feature, which one might, I suppose, call a generation gap, although the term would be misleading, because there is a clear break between the young and the middle-aged. And this dates roughly from 1976 onwards and the student uprising, when about 1,000 students were killed. What the students said to their parents was, the world you have brought us into is a world that is not fit to live in. And we blame you for having permitted the creation of this world. You suffered it to exist. You endured it. And we are not prepared to endure it. And we are prepared to challenge it and, if necessary, to die, because we do not think it is worth living in. We will either change it or we will die. And initially, there were many parents who begged their children not to get involved, you know, finish your schooling, get through high school, get a job, you know, settle down. This is just youthful madness. And so literally dialogue broke down between the students and their parents. What I think is important to note, that over the years, the parents have more and more been drawn onto the side of the students and are now, many of them, as committed as their children. I also think that occasionally, this may be a little unkind, parents who are involved in the struggle themselves will say, well, actually, it's out of our hands. The young have taken over. You know, but I think that's a way of avoiding possible repercussions for their own involvement, that they blame it on the young.
I was reading one report that one of the things that some young people are doing to basically punish people who are seen as being complicit with the white minority rule,
right,
is to necklace them and to take a tire that is filled with gasoline, put it around the offender's head, and set the tire on fire, thereby setting that person on fire. And it seems like such a very barbarous
act,
no matter what the person's offense is.
Right. Let me distinguish it, though, from what I was talking about, because when they punish, it's not a matter of the young punishing the old. It's young and old who mete out the punishment, and it is young and old who suffer the punishment. So it really doesn't have anything to do with age. I think one has to be very careful. There certainly have been instances of what is called necklacing. But some of them, and this is interesting to note, in Port Elizabeth, were almost certainly done by the police. Now, this is very clever in propaganda terms, because if you can discredit the opposition, and instead of them being people who have no vote and who would like to get the vote, which is a very reasonable demand, if you can instead present them as terrorists, that's the classic label, and you could also charge them with these acts of barbarism, then, of course, it discredits the entire movement. So let me say, on the one hand, first of all, I condemn it. Secondly, I don't deny that some of it has happened. But thirdly, that I think one ought to be cautious in assuming that all of it is done by people in the resistance who have identified an informer and who publicly punish him in this way. Some of the killings have turned out to be people who were leading the economic boycott in Port Elizabeth. some of them were the men who organized the protest that persuaded the New Zealand rugby team not to go to South Africa. And these are not people who would have been punished by the resistance movement. One must assume that they were killed instead by the police.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus, and he's this semester a guest professor at Swarthmore College. Well, you mentioned before that there are many actions planned, and some of them are planned around the anniversary of the Sharpeville massacre. Maybe for people who aren't very well acquainted with what the Sharpeville massacre was, before you describe what the upcoming protests are going to be like, what maybe you can refresh our memories about the Sharpeville massacre.
Good. And I will read a poem about it when we get back to the poetry. This was 1960 in March, March 21st, but it was something that took a long build-up. And essentially, it was a classic Gandhian-style protest where people said, we will no longer carry the passbook, we will hand it in to the police, and we will invite the police to arrest us. We will say that this is an unjust law, we will no longer obey it, and you can punish us for it. The police response instead was to machine gun people. They killed them in Port Elizabeth, in Cape Town, Johannesburg, Durban, Bloemfontein, across the country. But the most dramatic killing was at Sharpeville, this little ghetto outside Johannesburg, where 69 people were killed instantly, most of them shot in the back, fleeing from the police. They included a woman with a child in her arms, and the bullet pierced her body and penetrated the brain of the child, so they both died. And we commemorate that each year, Sharpeville Day and the Sharpeville Massacre, and there will be commemorations at the UN and elsewhere across the country on that day. But it was a turning point in South African history because it was then that the resistance decided that they could no longer rely exclusively on nonviolent protest because it wasn't sufficient, that the response of the government was to call out the army instead.
Are there protests planned for South Africa and in other countries to commemorate Sharpeville?
I'm sure. Indeed, last year in Port Elizabeth, on the anniversary of Sharpeville, 20 people were shot by the police. So the killings haven't stopped, and I'm sure there will be killings in this year in March. Anyway, what we are planning are national weeks of anti-apartheid action, starting on March 21st, which is the anniversary of the Sharpeville massacre, and going on all the way to April 4, which is the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, so that churches and colleges and trade unions across the country will be arranging events over that period. And if I could just give an address where people could write, the American Committee on Africa is coordinating protests. They have about 100 to 120 colleges already planning events over that period. And the address of the ACOA, American Committee on Africa, is 198 Broadway, New York, and the zip is 138. And I hope people will feel free to contact them for information. But, of course, they could also write to me at Swarthmore College, where I will be for the rest of this year, for information. But I honestly believe, as I said earlier, that if we can develop sufficient pressure, both from the outside and inside South Africa, between the two, we can achieve two things. We can redirect American policy towards South Africa. And secondly, we can force change inside South Africa.
Can I ask you to read some more of your poems?
Okay. So that I hope people will write to us and ask for information so that they can get themselves organized.
Let me reintroduce you, too. And my guest is Dennis Brutus, who is living in exile from South Africa. He's a poet who is a visiting professor of English at Swarthmore College. And he has a reading coming up at Swarthmore on March 21st, which is...
March 19th,
yeah, at Swarthmore College at 7:30 in the evening.
Good. Here's my Sharpeville poem, which is a deliberately prosy kind of factual poem again. What is important about Sharpeville is not that 70 died, nor even that they were shot in the back, retreating, unarmed, defenseless. And certainly not the heavy caliber slug that tore through a mother's back and ripped through the child in her arms, killing it. Remember Sharpeville, bullet in the back day, because it epitomized oppression and the nature of society more clearly than anything else. It was the classic event. Nowhere else is racial dominance more clearly defined. Nowhere the will to oppress more clearly demonstrated. What the world whispers, apartheid declares with snarling guns. The blood the rich lust after, South Africa spills in the dust. Remember Sharpeville. Remember bullet in the back day. And remember the unquenchable will for freedom. Remember the dead and be glad. Did you want me to go
on? Yeah, if you could read another poem.
Find another. It'll be difficult at short notice to make a random choice, but I did have something that I marked. This is one that deals with my prison experience, and it doesn't do too much as a poem, but perhaps does say something about the experience. When I went to Robben Island, I had already been shot by the secret police. I had a bullet injury. The bullet had gone through my body, entered my back, and come out of my chest. But then, on the island, I was assigned to carrying rocks out of the sea and building a wall on the island. And in the process, I was constantly beaten until my body was just a mass of bruises. And in the evening, the wardens would come and inspect me because it was such a mess. And the way I distanced myself from the experience was by looking at it with some amusement. It seemed to me I was rather like a freak in a sideshow at the circus or at a fair, a two-headed calf or a bearded lady or a tattooed lady. And in fact, that's what the poem says. For a while, I was the tattooed lady of the prison. And wardens would come to my section and get me to strip and stare and whistle in mingled pleasure and horror at the great purple bruise that ran from my neck down my back, from my neck to my thighs in a purple mass. What was I then? Mute, enduring reproach, heroic endurer, Christianly hero or submissive fool? What was I then that I cannot now imagine, cannot now judge?
Thanks for reading those poems. We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering, I know you'd like to go back to South Africa and that you plan to do that when the government changes. Do you think about how much it might have changed since you left there?
Yes, I would qualify that slightly and say I would prefer not to wait until it has actually changed. but actually go back and participate in the process of change. Of course it will have changed, but I suspect only in very material ways, superhighways and a great many more Holiday Inns and Sheratons, no doubt. In terms of the nature of the society and of the people, I think there will have been less change, so that it might be merely superficial and material. Certainly the landscape will not have changed much. It is a beautiful country, and that's hard to disfigure.
I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today and for reading some of your poems for us.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to do it, as you know. Thank you.
And my guest has been poet Dennis Brutus, who's living in exile from South Africa. He's currently living in the United States. This semester he's in Philadelphia, where he is a visiting professor at Swarthmore College. And he'll be doing a reading there that is free and open to the public on March 19th. It'll be at 7:30 in Kirby Hall. And I also want to mention, we recorded an interview a few months ago that was a biographical interview about his anti-apartheid work in South Africa and his subsequent imprisonment. So if you'd like to hear that interview, we're going to be featuring it on the Best of Fresh Air this Sunday at 6 o'clock. Well, it's 3 minutes to 5, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon. Schuylkill Expressway east and westbound through the reconstruction area. About a 15-minute delay at this hour. North on 95, a minor delay exiting at Woodhaven Road. Also, if you're traveling in New Jersey, a couple of accidents and some fire department activity messing up traffic. One in Magnolia on the White Horse Pike east of Evesham Road. Another accident just cleared in Lawnside on the White Horse Pike at Old Gloucester Pike. And finally, in Deptford, New Jersey, an accident on Lexington near Route 47. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Subaru. Tomorrow and Friday, we're going to devote the entire programs of Fresh Air to a discussion of AIDS. Tomorrow's program will be about the medical aspects of AIDS, how much we know about the disease, how we know about how the disease is spread. We'll be discussing safe sex. My guests will include a person who has AIDS, a buddy who works with people who has AIDS. We'll hear from a social worker, a doctor who tends to people who have AIDS, and from a Philadelphia epidemiologist. Friday's program will be about the social, political, and ethical issues that have been raised by AIDS. We'll hear from a gay author who's written a book on the politics of AIDS and how AIDS has changed life in the gay community. We'll hear from a media expert who will be discussing media coverage of AIDS. We'll hear from a lawyer who will be discussing some of the civil liberties questions raised by AIDS. We'll be hearing from a representative of the Philadelphia Blood Bank, of the Philadelphia Red Cross, who will discuss the blood supply. So that's coming up Thursday and Friday, two entire programs devoted to a discussion of AIDS. And again, this Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be Dennis Brutus, who we just heard from. The interview we're going to hear on Sunday is an interview that we recorded several months ago in which he discussed his life in South Africa before he was exiled, and we'll also discuss his imprisonment in that interview. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Jay Goldman and Dan Lachlan were the engineers. Production assistance from Mildred Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, which is coming up from National Public Radio. That will be followed by at 6:29 by 91 Report, our original news magazine. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm David Malpas with All Things Considered.
Whatever we do, it'll be merely dousing the fires when the embers remain, and it just takes one small thing for it to flare up again.
A description of the uneasy black township of Alexandra in South Africa. Tonight on All Things Considered, a conversation with Bishop Desmond Tutu.
Also, more bad weather out west.
A sense of the Senate resolution condemning the Philippine elections as a fraud, but Secretary of State George Shultz asked Congress not to cut off aid there as yet.
A new study says the cost to the nation of unwanted teenage pregnancies has doubled in the past decade.
And violinist Alexander Schneider.
Now, this news.
This is Brian Naylor. The Los Angeles bureau chief of an anti-Philippine government newspaper was shot to death today at his home. And according to California Senator Alan Cranston, the dead man, 41-year-old Oscar Salvatierra, had received a letter yesterday warning he would be executed. Salvatierra worked for the Philippine News, the largest Philippine-American newspaper in the U.S., which has taken a strong stand against the government of President Ferdinand Marcos. In Washington, the Senate today expressed its sense that the Philippine presidential election was a fraud and a resolution that was approved 85-9. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports.
The Senate resolution says the Philippine election was marked by such widespread fraud that it cannot be considered a fair reflection of the will of the people. Although the resolution does not advocate specific American action, one of its supporters, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy,